This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Once upon a time, earning a PhD in America meant you were on your way to a career in academia. With a degree in hand, you had a pretty good shot at a full professorship, research support, and the backing and credibility of a university.
Back in 1970, America was producing about a third of the world's university students and half of the world's science and technology PhDs. So there were plenty of students for all those aspiring professors to teach. But times have changed, and since then, much of the rest of the world got busy handing out their own doctorates, and the result is a global glut of PhDs.
Too many would-be professors chasing too few jobs. And here's a stunning statistic. Between 2005 and 2009, America produced 100,000 doctoral degrees, but only 16,000 new professorships. Add to that the recent recession, and the problem of too many PhDs and too few jobs is more acute than ever.
So what are all these highly qualified, but often under or unemployed PhDs to do? Well, John Wilkins, who earned a PhD from Harvard back in 2002, has an idea. He's established something called the Ronan Institute, which we read about recently in the Boston Globe. It's a brand new nonprofit, and the aim is to connect all those unemployed or underemployed PhDs with grant money, with research projects, with fellow academics, and credibility, all outside the walls of traditional university or college. And John Wilkins joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, John. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's such an interesting idea. So give us a quick mission statement of the Ronan Institute. I described it quickly there, but let me get you to put it in your words.
Yeah, it's really, as you said, it's to support, promote, and encourage independent scholarship for people to pursue academic research in non-traditional ways.
So a new model, a new way forward for the highly educated who might not have ways to work or do their research. You are one of those PhDs without a professorship. You earned a doctorate, if I'm right about this, in biophysics from Harvard in 2002, right?
That's correct.
So tell us briefly about your experience as a newly minted PhD and how it led you to the Ronan Institute.
Well, for me, and I would say, you know, among the people who we have affiliated right now and people who I speak with, you know, there are a subset of people who, you know, would really love to have a university professorship and just haven't been able to find one or haven't been able to find one that works for them. For others, and I count myself among this, that's not actually the goal, that there are actually a lot of aspects of the traditional academic system that, you know, don't work for everyone. It tends to require a certain degree of narrowness of focus. You need, particularly before you get tenure, you have to focus on research that your particular department will find interesting. Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, you want to be, say, actively involved in with your family, you know, a lot of academics work 60, 70-hour weeks. It basically means you have to abandon sort of any breadth of interest or outside interests. I had always managed to have very non-traditional positions. After I got my PhD, I was a junior fellow in the Harvard Society of Fellows, which allowed me freedom to work on whatever I wanted for 3 years. Then I was a professor at the Santa Fe Institute for 6 years, which is a small interdisciplinary research institute where you're encouraged to sort of pursue harebrained ideas. So, you know, to me, what I want is sort of, you know, an absolute complete freedom.
So absolute complete freedom to do research, but you need support that a university that a university would provide for you. Correct?
That's right. Obviously, you need a degree of financial support so that you can pay your bills. You need things like library access. But I think, you know, more important than that, I think for a lot of people is you need a sense of community, a set of colleagues and a sense of sort of shared purpose. I think that's one thing that a lot of people get, you know, even if you're a sort of a hermit academic and you go to your office every day and close the door and work on your stuff. I think even the process of walking across a university campus makes you feel connected to something bigger. And that's something that I think a lot of people outside the university system don't have. They feel sort of isolated and like they're sort of in this alone. And so one of the things that we hope to do is sort of network these people together and give them a sense of of purpose.
So a network of folks who are still interested in research, interested in their fields of study. Also, you want to link them together with grant money, for example, right?
That's right. So one of the things that, you know, a university department would typically provide is grant support. And that might be someone who helps to identify funding opportunities, someone who helps to put grant proposals together. That includes, you know, doing all the, you know, the hours of clicking on the website that's mm-hmm. involved in every grant proposal submission, but also writing boilerplate information. And then there's grants management, particularly for funding that comes from federal agencies. There tends to be a lot of sort of accounting and reporting requirements. So that's one thing that I think that we can provide for independent scholars is that will help them to acquire funding and to sort of, you know, account for it and make good use of it.
Now, I understand you're just a few months old. You've just established this nonprofit. Take us down the road, say 5 or 10 years. In your dream, what will this institute, what will the Ronan Institute look like? How will it be set up? Who will be there? How many people? Who will it be serving?
You know, the question of exactly how big is sort of an open question because it is very much an experiment. You know, I think the numbers make it very clear that there are tens of thousands of underemployed PhDs out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, what fraction of them really actually want to be actively involved in scholarship moving forward? You know, I think, you know, some people, when they finish their PhD, what they discover is, oh, this wasn't for me. Or maybe they get a job in finance and they are happy making a lot more money than any scholar makes.
Sure.
But I can easily imagine this being something that was, you know, fairly small, where there was a, you know, small collection of 40 or 50 people. Or I can also imagine it being a network of 1,000 people. And it really will depend on, as the experiment goes on and we develop sort of our various programs, what works, which things we're able to successfully raise money to do to support people, and what things we feel like make the most impact. And then how many people are interested in really, you know, coming and getting involved. And, you know, some of this will be people who fell out of academia maybe 10 years ago, say. You know, maybe they left to have kids and they would like to get back in. You know, how many of the people out there in that boat actually want to get back in? My guess is it's a lot of them, but it remains to be seen.
Let me ask you, John, about your experience. You have this doctorate in biophysics. Is this something that you, I mean, you're involved in setting up this institute. How might this institute help you in particular with your field of research?
It's in my field in particular, and I really what I work on is theoretical evolutionary biology. You know, I think one thing, having an institutional affiliation is actually critical in a mm-hmm. funny way. And it's when you submit a grant application or submit a paper, and I know, like, when I'm reviewing these things, one of the first things you do is you look at the name on the paper. And if you know that person by reputation and you say, ah, yes, this person, I know their work, they do good work, that sort of sets the stage for how you read their paper. If you don't know the person's name, you tend to fall back on secondary signals like, what university are they at? Are they at a good place?
Mm-hmm.
And but if you get a paper that is from someone who has a street address, that to most academics sends off a bunch of red warning flags.
Yeah, like why isn't this guy?
This guy's really clearly a kook.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are some fields like maybe mathematics where, you know, actually the notion of the crazy genius who lives in his mother's basement and solves, you know, some proof that wins him a $1 million prize that he then turns down. You know, that's sort of something we expect from mathematics. But in most other fields, I think, you know, we assume that if someone is not affiliated with an institution, that they must be crazy and or not very good. And I think that's not true. So that's one thing that we can provide.
Listeners, we're talking to John Wilkins. He's founder of something called the Ronan Institute. It's a new model to connect PhDs with grant money, work, with each other. Let us know what you think. Are you one of the many PhDs out there looking for work in your field? And if so, does this sound like a good idea to you? Tell us your story. Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. and find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. John Wilkins, just tell us briefly, the Ronan Institute, tell us about the name Ronan, because it sort of tells a nice story about what your underlying philosophy here.
Yeah, the idea is the Ronin is a masterless samurai. So traditionally in feudal Japan, if you were a samurai and you lost your master, either because they were killed or because you got fired or because you quit, you were supposed to commit suicide. And the Ronin were the ones who said, no, we're not going to commit suicide. And many of them went off and they took mercenary work or became bodyguards. And of course, you know, the parallel to academia is, I think, really striking. The conventional wisdom is, if you are a scholar and you lose an affiliation with a university, either because you can't find a job or you quit or your university runs out of money, you're supposed to commit professional suicide. You're supposed to say, well, I guess I can't do scholarship anymore. And what we're here to say is, no, you can. You can continue to wield your two academic swords and be an independent scholar.
Victoria, I want to introduce another voice into this conversation, Victoria Blodgett. She's the Assistant Dean and Director for Career Services at the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Yale University. She's been standing by listening. Victoria Blodgett, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invite.
There are a couple of things I want to ask you about this particular situation, this glut of PhDs. But first, you know, what do you hear in John Wilkins' idea on the Ronan Institute? Does it sound like an idea that responds to a real need out there?
Well, I think so. And I think it's an interesting way to put it as a new model, because I think it is an absolutely new model for allowing PhDs and real scholars the freedom to continue to pursue their subject. And John's just right that's a very difficult thing to find. And the bottom line is I'm supportive of any sort of viable way for PhDs who are interested in doing so to advance their academic career path or their research career path. So I think these kinds of, you know, John's entrepreneurial way of thinking about this is really a good one.
And let me ask you about this glut of PhDs. We gave a very sort of quick explanation at the top about the sort of global glut of PhDs. But why is there, go deeper into that. Why is there such a surplus of PhDs and this mismatch between the number of PhDs and available jobs right now?
Well, I think there are actually a number of factors that are coming together at the same time. Four that I would point out kind of initially. One is that there is, in fact, an aging faculty that are resistant to retirement for whatever reason. You know, they're interested in continuing to think about their subject, or they were hit with the 2008 recession sort of thing. But we have an aging faculty and no mandatory retirement age. So they are taking up the faculty lines that might previously had opened for the newer scholars. So we have that issue. Number two is, just as you said, we have more schools that are offering PhDs than ever before. Even in this country, we have more schools offering the PhD, many of whom see it as a way to actually generate more tuition income, so that they're wanting to produce those degrees for that reason as well. And as they produce those scholars, they're also producing greater teaching faculty for their campuses without having to hire external scholars to fill those teaching needs. Hmm. I think thirdly, there is a dwindling amount of federal and state contribution to higher education. And so institutions are looking for ways to trim the sails, and one of the ways that they do that is looking at personnel for cutting those lines. And so some of those faculty positions are no longer being filled.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a lot going on there. John Wilkins, does that jive with sort of what you've observed? And if so, should universities be doing more, I guess, preparing PhDs for the real marketplace out there, maybe even sending the message out more clearly that there is an oversupply?
You know, I think they should do everything they can to, you know, give people realistic expectations going in. And I think to a certain extent, this sort of crisis about the overproduction of PhDs has been prevalent enough and in the news for enough years now that I think most people going into graduate school, you know, have a more realistic notion. I think one of the challenges is, in terms of thinking about any career that's not becoming a university professor, is when you're in grad school, of course, all of your mentors and supervisors are people who did become university professors. So mm-hmm. even if they are well-intentioned and would like to give you a broader sort of set of skills, they may not have them because that's the path that they followed.
Listeners, we're talking to John Wilkins. He's the founder of something called the Ronan Institute. It's a new idea that would connect PhDs who don't have jobs with a regular university, with grant money, with work, with each other. Also with us is Assistant Dean and Director for Career Services at the Graduate Schools of Arts and Sciences at Yale University, Victoria Blodgett. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. If you're one of those PhDs looking for work in your field, we'd love to hear from you. Does the idea of the Ronan Institute make sense to you? Is it a good idea? Give us your call. Tell us your story. Let's take a call. Tom is calling from Atkinson, New Hampshire. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Back in the springtime, a year ago or so, there was the uprising in the Arab Spring in Egypt, and there was an interview with a fellow that was an electrical engineer with a PhD. It was an elevator operator, and he was very dissatisfied with that elevator operator. But where were his opportunities? I'll take any comments off the line. Thank you very much.
So where was his? Well, let me come to you, Victoria Blodgett. You know, how are universities, what can universities do to prepare PhDs for this current marketplace? And Tom was talking there, I guess, about a highly overqualified elevator operator, and there's lots of stories and statistics to back those kinds of stories up.
Well, I think, you know, there are two things. There's one, what can the student themselves do in the process of taking a PhD that will help them to understand better the skills and traits and experiences that they're gaining along the way that are transferable, some kind of self-awareness sorts of initiatives on their part. But I also think I agree with John by saying that universities can really make available to PhDs a broader breadth of professional development opportunities that allow them to have an even longer list of transferable skills and experiences. You know, public speaking, which they do a lot, but to actually give them opportunities to understand public speaking in a different way or you know, those kinds of professional skills, I think, are important to do. And many of our peer institutions are doing that.
Mm-hmm. John, I'm interested in the idea of the Ronan Institute. What kind of field of study would it be most helpful to? In other words, do you see it helping people who have PhDs in the sciences, the soft sciences, the humanities, the liberal arts? I mean, what's your feeling about the kind of PhD that this might reach?
You know, I think basically anybody where the primary tool that you bring to bear on your studies is your knowledge and your brain. So I think it might not work very well for sort of, you know, experimental high-energy particle physics.
Sure, where you need an expensive lab and equipment. Right. Right.
You know, or certain fields of experimental biology. But, you know, most of the sciences in which – you know, where people do theoretical or computational work, it's consistent with that. And most things, I think, that anyone in the social sciences or humanities does. And one of the things that's, you know, that's different now than, say, 20 years ago is sort of with, you know, it's cliche, right? But it's the, you know, it's the internet. You know, the fact is, 20 years ago, if you wanted to be a scholar, you needed to be at a university to be where you know, the books were, to be where the resources were of whatever it was you were working on. Now, I think you could be off somewhere, and if you have, you know, a connection to the, you know, 18th century German literature that you need to study, then you can do that work whether or not you're at a university.
Let's take a couple more calls. Let's go to Tracy, who's calling from Newton. Hi, Tracy. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I was just calling to say, to echo the sentiment of one of the panel members there who said that the university professors don't train students who aren't interested in going into teaching. I'm getting my PhD from the University of Chicago in Latin American history, and I really am not sure of what other organizations or programs are out there for me, and I've been looking on my own, but you know, trying to get guidance from professors. I really didn't have any of those going through my program because I didn't want to teach, and it's been very frustrating.
Tracy, thanks so much for that call. Victoria Blodgett, any advice for Tracy?
I think that faculty are really training scholars in a topic or a subject. And along the way, they are also training them in lots of areas that are skill-based. So in, you know, unmatched research skills, writing skills, capacity for learning enormous amounts of information very quickly, working under pressure, or the ability to work really hard and persistently, and flexibility, and all of those things that come with the process of getting a PhD is the other way to look at your experience as a scholar. So it's either the topic or the process. And you can market yourself for careers that support the topic, the professoriate, that kind of direction, or you can look for careers that also allow you to market your set of skills that you've gained along the way. So I think it's important that people that are putting themselves out on the job market think of themselves as broader, employable people. They're not just employable because they have that particular subject, but they're employable because of the skills and traits that they possess and have developed along the way.
And do you
think, so I would encourage her to think more broadly about that.
Right. Tracy, thanks so much for that call. Victoria, should doctoral applicants be talking to their schools before they start their degree about career prospects and job training?
I do think it's important that students be aware of that. I think there are a couple of things that enter into it, is that there is a sense, particularly for students at the elite institutions, that, yes, it's true that there are only 16,000 faculty jobs produced in the last few years, but there is the sense that they will actually be successful in getting one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the not me syndrome. Yes, that must apply to other people. It won't happen to me. I think that's one of the things that happens. But I do think it's important that students interview schools and really think about kind of long-term hopes and dreams that they have for their own career paths. I think that doesn't happen very often, however.
John Wilkins, I'm interested to know, in terms of when you go out there and sort of establish this institute, do you expect to have difficulty attracting grant money from foundations without the backing of a university? You made reference to this earlier in the segment, but that seems like a big challenge.
You know, I don't think that we will. Obviously, you know, it remains to be seen. But, you know, the fact is, if you can, you know, connect this, and this, again, this is one of the things that having a professional grants person can really help you to do. If you can speak with the appropriate program officer, make them really understand the project. The fact is, most people at foundations, whether it's a, you know, private foundation or a federal funding agency, you know, they're excited to fund science or, you know, or a social sciences humanities project. And if you can convince them of the value and interest of the project, I think they'll be happy to fund it. And they, at that point, won't care.
Well, John Wilkins, we wish you all the luck in the world. It's a fascinating idea, and it comes at a time, obviously, when we're looking for great ideas. So thanks so much for bringing it to us. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
That's John Wilkins. He's founder of the Ronan Institute. And we also spoke to Victoria Blodgett, Assistant Dean and Director for Career Services at the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Yale University. Victoria Blodgett, thanks so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, the Celtics turn up the heat in Miami. We'll talk sports with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.